think of things like Martin Luther's writing in the plague, saying, if as a follower of Jesus you are afraid and you have to leave, that's fine. Leave. But if you stay to take care of others and you die, you've died a good death.
Thanks for joining us today on the show. My name is Micah Fries, and I'm obviously not a doctor, but I'm playing one today on TV. I'm in this medical gear because in today's show, Ed's going to interview an Ebola survivor along with his wife. Dr. Kent Brantley was one of the few Americans who contracted the deadly Ebola virus while working in West Africa. He and his wife were missionaries with Samaritan's Purse, which was responsible for the only Ebola treatment unit in all of southern Liberia. Kent was on the cover of Time Magazine's 2014 Person of the Year, the Ebola Fighters issue. Now, Kent and his wife, Amber, have chronicled their experiences of being at the epicenter of the Ebola crisis, and Kent's struggle to survive the deadly virus in the book called For Life, How Loving Our Neighbor Led Us Into the Heart of the Ebola Epidemic. Now, if you're new to the show today, The Exchange is a place where we engage in true thoughts and theology, hoping to compel one another to love and good deeds. You can engage with us on social media using the hashtag TheExchange. Now, before we get into the interview, let's hear from Pastor Derwin Gray about the gospel and religion.
The word gospel was a word that followers of this Jewish Messiah kind of hijacked from the Roman Empire. And so whenever there was a new Caesar, like say Nero, when he was enthroned as emperor, he would dispatch apostles throughout the Roman Empire, and they would go to the city centers as apostles, as messengers, to give out good news, and they would blow a trumpet and say, "We've got good news. Nero is the new king. Confess him as Lord and Savior. Bow your knee to him and he will bring you peace and prosperity." Well, the first century followers of Jesus, his apostles, said, no. There is a new king and his name is Jesus. And these apostles went out throughout the Greco-Roman context, heralding and proclaiming true good news. God himself, the eternal Son of God, came to earth, that Jesus, this new king, and by grace, he brings us into his kingdom as we exercise faith in him and we bow our knee and confess that he is Lord, that he is Savior, that he is King, and through his spirit and through his life, he creates this community and gives this community all that it would need to do the bidding of the king. So that is good news. Good news is not good advice. And I say this humbly, not as one who is yet to arrive, but just as someone who's passionate about Jesus and his kingdom. We don't need good advice. Good advice is what humans need to do to fix their lives. But good news is an announcement of what Jesus has done to rescue us for time and eternity and to equip us to be the future and the present as his resurrection life is in us as a community.
Well, thanks for joining us on The Exchange. What a fascinating story. I mean, the whole world watched, and you can see the picture on the back of the book, you getting out of that ambulance. What were you thinking as you're getting out of that ambulance that day?
That day I was focused on putting one foot in front of another.
Yeah.
That's all I was thinking about as the paramedic helped me down. People asked, "Did you know about the helicopter?" I had no idea.
Well,
it took every bit of effort I had to put one foot in front of another.
Just to get through. So let's go back to the beginning of the story. That's the part where most of us saw the story. But tell me, how did you end up in Africa? What happened there? Why go there?
We looked at a number of mission agencies, and we had met with World Medical Mission, which is a branch of Samaritan's Purse, and met them at a conference in Louisville called the Global Missions Health Conference. And so Kent had been really interested in their post-residency program, where they would match Kent with a mentor on the foreign field for a two-year commitment. In another year, at the same conference, he met Dr. Rick Sacra, and they really, really connected and shared a common vision, and he told us about Liberia, and our first, we first had to ask, where's that? And then we signed up. We said, sure, let's go there. And then we started reading everything there is to read about Liberia. And it was really our connection with Rick Sacra and the post-residency program that got us there in the first place.
How long were you there before you got sick and ended up being world news?
We were only there 9 months.
9 months, okay. Okay, so you go to Liberia, right? So America got, and not everyone watched it'll be from the States, but America got hysterical when it had a case or a two, et cetera, et cetera. But the situation is very different in West Africa, and Americans have sometimes difficulty paying attention to something that's not in Dallas. So talk to us a little bit about what's going on, what was going on there when the disease began to rage. A lot of people, you know, they've heard of Ebola, never been a situation like this where Ebola has broken out at this level before in recorded history. Tell us about it.
But I think it is important for people to understand what was going on there. I mean, this outbreak wasn't isolated to one hospital in one city in one part of the country. It was quickly growing and spreading across three neighboring countries and affecting every part of society. And at its worst, in August and September of 2014, there were 300 or 400 new cases diagnosed each week. Mm. And there were not enough beds in the treatment units. There were people laying in the street outside treatment units waiting for another patient to die so that they could have a bed inside the treatment unit. But I think what's more important for people to know than what it was like there a year ago,
right,
is that the outbreak is not over.
It's over in Dallas, so Americans think that it's over. So talk to us about what's going on even now as we're filming.
A lot of the world heard the news on May 9th that Liberia was declared Ebola-free,
right,
by the World Health Organization. But even at that time, Guinea and Sierra Leone continued to have a low number of cases. It's much less than a year ago, 20 to 30 new cases a week. But even just last week, there were 2 or 3 new cases diagnosed in Liberia, which had been Ebola-free. And what people need to understand is that until we get to 0 cases in the whole region for 42 days, the outbreak's not over.
Mm-hmm.
And just because it's not happening in Dallas anymore doesn't mean we should forget about it and turn a blind eye. We need to remember these people are still our neighbors. And although it's not a disaster of the magnitude of last fall, there's still people dying. There's still entire societies that have been disrupted and cannot return to normal until this thing is over.
The book is called Called for Life, but then the subtitle is what you just mentioned, how loving our neighbor led us into the heart of the Ebola epidemic. Okay, so loving our neighbor, you're making a theological justification for ministering, using the scriptures, for ministering among Ebola patients. But why should Americans care? I mean, is it just theological, or are there health concerns as well? This didn't seem to just be isolated in one place.
That question is hard for me to wrestle with, because there are a lot of pragmatic reasons to tell, even to persuade even non-believers to be concerned about the well-being of people on the other side of the world.
Right. And we saw the military and CDC and others try to do that using well-being means, but that's not where you went.
Well, I mean, that's a very important aspect of it, and I think it's a mistake to try to divorce that from the theological,
right,
motivations as well. We live in a global community. That is a fact of life in our world today, and I think the United States government recognized that as they tried to intervene in Liberia and encourage other national governments to intervene in the region. But as followers of Jesus, we also know that the most important commands that God ever gave humanity were love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. And so we, among all people, ought to recognize in our global society that we live in now that our neighbors include not only the people around us, but the people on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so that theological motivation ought to carry over into our global society, not just our local community.
But Amber, you almost lost your husband ministering to your neighbor in the global community. As this was happening, what's going through your mind as you're hearing this news and you're isolated from him? And what are you thinking during this process?
The days were eternally long, and the nights were even longer. while he was sick, my thoughts were, I waited every morning in the wee hours to hear his first call or get his first text message that he had made it through the night and that we could, you know, get through one more day together, even though we were so far apart. I knew that he comforted me because he was so much at peace, that he had already made the decision that whether he lived or died, it was all for his message of spreading Jesus' name and making him famous. And he was comforted by that, and to die was gain for him. And so I didn't want to have to be doing this by myself.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that he's...
Yeah, it's a co-authored book.
We're doing
thankful
it together.
That there's two of you.
Yeah.
So, were you ready to die?
I was scared.
Yeah.
I was anxious. I think it was too intense in the moment for me to be able to tell you, yes, I was ready to die.
Right.
I thought I was going to die.
Did you?
And so I was becoming okay with that. But I was still scared and anxious like anybody would be.
I imagine.
He was anxious because he was lonely, too. I think that increased his anxiety. Most of the time he was peaceful and reassuring, but for long hours when he was between doctor visits, he was really anxious to be alone.
And I want to talk some about the dehumanizing and the isolation. One of the things that here that created a bit of a stir in the Christian community was an article written by Ann Coulter, who tends to write some articles that tend to create a stir intentionally. But in there, she sort of said, why are you going there? I'm paraphrasing, but I won't paraphrase the one part, when you could have gone to Los Angeles and win one Hollywood executive to Christ. And the implied rebuke was very clear. You're going over there. Why aren't you here? So why were you not in L.A. winning one Hollywood executive to Christ, as Ann Coulter, in her brilliant missiological way of thinking? That's deep sarcasm and irony. Why not? Why there instead of Ann Coulter's advice?
I had a mentor in college who was had been a missionary in Africa for 15 years, and he took me and a couple other young men under his wing to mentor us, and we were all kind of in the beginning stages of wondering if God was calling us to be missionaries. And one of the things that I remember learning from him is that God has called all of us, and if in answering that call you are able and willing to go to a faraway or difficult place, then you should, because there are plenty of people who are not able or willing to go, who are willing to stay, who are able to stay where they are. But if you're able and willing, then do it.
From the creators of Courageous and Fireproof comes War Room, a powerful new film about fighting life's battles in prayer.
This is my favorite place in this house. I call it my war room.
Because prayer is a powerful weapon. War Room, in theaters August 28th, starring Alex Kendrick, Priscilla Shirer, and Beth Moore.
We need an army of believers. Raise them up, Lord. Raise them up.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. Tickets and showtimes available now at warroomthemovie.com.
Welcome back to the show. Our guests today on The Exchange are Dr. Kent Brantley, the missionary doctor who survived Ebola, and his wife, Amber. We're going to jump back into that discussion in a minute, but first, let's learn from Focus on the Family's Kelly Rosati.
Hi, I'm Kelly Rosati, Vice President of Community Outreach at Focus on the Family, and I'm excited to chat with you a little bit today about the issue of adoption and what it means in our churches, what it means for the gospel, and how easy it is to get involved in any way in a church level. So the first thing that gets us excited at Focus on the Family about adoption is the fact that adoption, as John Piper says, is the visible gospel. It is a picture of what God has done for us through faith in Jesus Christ. And it's amazing when you see what he does through the practical aspects of adoption. In our family, we are multi-ethnic. We're all mixed up, as we used to say in Hawaii where we lived. We are Korean, Hawaiian, Filipino, Chinese, Vietnamese, Micronesian, Italian, and Irish. And one of the things that I've noticed is that when we just move in a herd, in a church setting, people notice, and without us saying a word or doing anything, it brings up the opportunity to talk about why it is that we got involved in adoption. And I think that is the case for so many families. Adoption has been a practical, everyday, rubber meets the road way in which we have experienced living out the gospel. And so you've got adoptive families in your churches who are doing this every day, and you've got lots of people who feel passionate about the cause of adoption, but they're not going to adopt themselves. And so they want to know what they can do to get involved. And that's what we think is really good news, that whether you can cook, clean, pray, drive, babysit, shop, do laundry. If you can do any of those things, you can make a huge impact in the life of former orphans and their new adoptive families right in your congregation. You can literally wrap around those adoptive families and help them succeed. And the reason why this is so essential for the gospel is because when people watch and they see children welcomed into families, they take notice and they think, what's that about? And when they keep watching and they see church families wrapping around and doing the journey of adoption with those families, it causes those who are watching to say, what in the world is that about? And as we all know, what it's about is Jesus Christ. And it's a wonderful opportunity to proclaim the gospel in our lives through word and deed, as part of adoption, as part of wrapping around adoptive families.
So Kent, we asked you to sign what would not be a protective suit in any Ebola or any infectious disease circumstance. But nonetheless, this is something that you did while you were, and others did, while you were treating patients with Ebola. Talk to us a little bit about this, because people may not be aware of the isolation and the dehumanizing effect of the disease. Why does it matter? Why would you write a name? Tell us about that.
When I was a patient at Emory, the doctors and nurses had suits that had a big face shield. I could see their entire face. But the suits that we were using in Liberia covered us every inch of our bodies except for our eyes. We had on clear goggles so that our eyes could be seen. But that means our patients could see nothing human in their caretakers other than their eyes. And we all looked the same in those suits with the masks and everything. So putting our names on the suits served as a way of allowing our patients, the ones who were able to read, to see who it was that was approaching them. We wrote them on the front and on the back so they could see who was around them. It also helped us as a team to be able to identify each other as we were working together, to be able to say, oh, that's Ed, that's not Julie or whoever.
One of the historic realities of the church is, Rodney Stark writes about this in a book he wrote about, Cities of God. He's a researcher, and he said that in the second and third century, there are plagues that swept through what was then the Roman world. And one of the things that the Romans said about the Christians was they cared not only for their own sick, but for our sick as well. And that became a great turning point in the history of the global spread of the Christian movement. So why do you think, because you talked about here in your book, right at the very beginning, page 2, you say, I had determined to display compassion over fear. Why is that so important, not just in general, but for those who want to see the gospel of Jesus Christ advanced?
I think the gospel is a message of compassion over fear. We're called to love our neighbors, and that can be a fear-invoking experience to engage with your neighbors, whether they're someone different than you or a person that you have a disagreement with, or there are a lot of a lot of things in life that can cause fear, but we are called to be people of compassion, to love others the way we have been loved by God. And I think it is a determination you have to make in every interaction. And I by no means have been perfect at that. And we all end up choosing fear in some circumstance, but I think our calling is to love our neighbors, to have compassion, to choose that compassion over every other possible response.
Amber, in the book, you said, page 23, you said, and the book I should mention is of course, Called for Life, How Loving Our Neighbor Led Us to the Heart of the Ebola Epidemic. You said, in page 23, but I really wanted to be back in Liberia. Our work was there. Our people were there. At what point did the people of Liberia become our people, and why is that important?
That was still a work in progress for us, moving into a new culture and acclimating. But we moved there because our aim was to show love to the people of Liberia and our neighbors there. And hopefully we did that. Liberia was not an easy place to live. It's not easy to live cross-culturally anywhere, and I think the differences were blaring at times, and we were still going through transition and culture shock, but we deeply love the people of Liberia, and I did feel like we'd been called there by God, and we had made our home there, and we were raising our kids there, and it was our home.
It's hard because you're not there now.
Right.
And so I can see the emotion even in there. So what now? I mean, you care for the people of Liberia. You're here, you're writing a book. What are ways and things, either of you, that we can or should be doing to care about the peoples of Liberia, but all of West Africa? We could say all the world, but this right now is where the Ebola epidemic is still at work. What should we be doing?
I think it's really important for people to one, have an awareness mm-hmm. of what's happening, in specifically like you're talking about, in that region of the world. Ebola is still ravaging those societies, and the numbers may not be as great, but the societies are being devastated by the impacts of that disease. Secondly, people need to do something practical to help. And I've called on lots of people to pray, and I am so thankful to all of the people who prayed for me when I was sick. And we've heard from thousands, hundreds of thousands. Sure. I think there were probably actually millions of people praying for me.
Our family prayed for you together, and for Nancy as well.
So. And I'm so thankful for that. And I plead with people, pray for the people of West Africa.
Yeah.
You can also do something. Yeah. You can donate money to organizations like Samaritan's Purse that are on the front lines taking care
Samaritan's Purse, which is part of, you are working in the medical kind of subsidiary or arm of Samaritan's Purse. Many of us know Franklin Graham.
Right.
And so that's an area people can give. Okay.
And there are other organizations there on the front lines helping in community development, helping in the Ebola response. Mm-hmm. Donate to those organizations. Yeah. If you're a healthcare professional, mm-hmm. see if there's a spot for you to volunteer with an organization like MSF, Doctors Without Borders, or the Red Cross, or some organization that is there mm-hmm. helping take care of patients with Ebola, helping spread community awareness, helping stop the spread of this outbreak.
See, I know part of your concern, part of my concern is that because we're Americans, we tend to Americanize things, and so you are the face of the Ebola epidemic for a lot of Americans. Yet you're not the face of the Ebola epidemic. A lot of Americans don't see the face of the Ebola epidemic is Africans throughout West Africa who are suffering. And so giving and going are key things. So would you discourage people from going now? Or would you still say, no, there's a place we need? I mean, you got sick. We need physicians and medical professionals, nurses and others there serving?
I think you have to be wise about what you do, where you go. But I think we need people going to render aid right now. Mm-hmm. That goes back to the idea of allowing compassion to trump our fear.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a need for people, not the numbers that were needed a year ago
right.
when we needed hundreds and thousands of volunteers, but there is still a need, and the people who are there working, you have to imagine they're exhausted by now,
yeah.
and they need help.
And this is going to come again. It may not be Ebola, It may be a resurgent Spanish flu. It may be a thousand other things. And this is going to come again. And Christians can either run away in fear, but sometimes Christians will run towards, right? You know, we hear the firefighters run towards the fire. Christians will run towards, and it will cost them their lives. Now, it didn't cost you your life, but historically we know that Christians who cared for the sick and the hurting sometimes perished with the sick and the hurting. Would our conversation be different? I know it'd be different in some ways, but how would it be different if you hadn't lived? Would we be saying this is a bad idea? Or what would people say afterwards? What would you say, Amber?
I think it would be a different conversation.
Yeah.
I don't know how to approach that. I haven't thought through that very much because I've just been so grateful that we're not looking at it that way. But I think people would still be applauding Kent as a hero of the faith, as a martyr. Yeah. Even though he didn't suffer persecution for being a Christian, he was there because he is a Christian. I don't know, and I would be preaching, well, he was just a regular guy who was was there and wrong place, wrong time, maybe, but he stepped up to the plate and
wrong place, wrong time, right cause, right Jesus.
Yes.
Yeah. Who'd you have?
I think of things like Martin Luther's writing in the plague, saying, if as a follower of Jesus you are afraid and you have to leave, that's fine, leave. But if you stay to take care of others and you die, you've died a good death. Mm. And I think about stories like Jim Elliot and Nate Saint, and you see the legacy that it seemed like a tragedy when those young men were murdered in their efforts to reach out to this tribal group in the Amazon. But look at the legacy they've left and the legacy that their families have continued to carry on, to return to those people, to embrace those people who murdered their fathers as brothers in Christ. I think that's an incredible legacy, and I don't know how this story would have played out had it ended differently. But my hope and my faith says that God works good out of the bad.
Thanks so much for joining us for today's show. For resources mentioned in the show, visit edstetzer.com. And while you're there, you can check out some of our past episodes. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you have a great week.
Thanks for joining Ed Stetzer and his team for this week's radio edition of The Exchange. Hear this and other past broadcasts of The Exchange. Read up on the latest trends from Lifeway Research and insights and articles from Ed and his team by visiting edstetzer.com. The Exchange Radio has been presented by Lifeway Christian Resources in cooperation with Faith Radio and Northwestern Media.